Werbung.
Was bietet eigentlich deine Bank? Hier drei Vorteile von Trade Republic. Kostenloses Konto mit Karte. 2% Zinsen. Investieren ab einem Euro. Und falls du mal Fragen hast, kannst du Trade Republic rund um die Uhr erreichen. Du kannst anrufen und sprichst mit echten Menschen, die dir helfen. 24 Stunden am Tag, 7 Tage die Woche. Also, mach es so wie 10 Millionen Kunden von Trade Republic und lass dein Geld für dich arbeiten. Hol dir die App und eröffne dein Konto in weniger als 5 Minuten. Kapitalanlagen bergen Risiken. Zinsen von Partnerbanken. Dividenden aus Geldmarktfonds mit Kursrisiken.
Werbung Ende.
Die Übersetzung von Jans Stimme vom Deutschen ins Englische wurde mit einer KI erstellt.
The Iraqi government, they are doing nothing for us, especially the Yazidi community. You see that people are going abroad, for example, to Europe, from all other countries. They give them their rights there. They give them the stay in Europe, for example. We are as Yazidis in our country, and we don't have our rights.
That's what a man told me in Sinjar. It's a region in northwestern Iraq. And this man has returned there. He's living in his home region again, and yet he says, we have no rights here. How can that be? The Sinjar region is the homeland of the Yazidis, a religious minority in Iraq that now also has a large diaspora community in Germany. And in 2014, 12 years ago now, the so-called Islamic State swept through the region and overran it. Hundreds of thousands of Yazidis were driven from their homes. Thousands were killed, literally massacred, and thousands of women and girls were abducted. The German Bundestag has recognized the crimes committed against the Yazidis as genocide. There is aid, there are projects in the region, and there are places where reconstruction is underway. And yet, many of those who suffered back then have still not truly returned. Why is that?
In crisis mode. The podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Hello, I am Jan Jessen, war and crisis reporter for the Funke Media Group. In this episode of In Crisis Mode, I take you to the Sinjar region. I was there a few days ago, spoke with returnees, with people trying to rebuild their lives, and with Irfan Ortak, the chairman of the Central Council of the Yazidis in Germany. Yes, Sinjar is a very, very special region, it has to be said, as mentioned, in northwestern Iraq. And to even get there, you need an Iraqi visa, which is always somewhat complicated to obtain. In my case, I first had to travel via Egypt, then to Baghdad, and from there on to Erbil, the capital of the autonomous region of Kurdistan, before finally continuing to Sinjar. And yes, Sinjar is essentially a military restricted area. You also need special permits to move around there. The region is marked by countless checkpoints. At some point I said or wrote, in Sinjar there is a kind of war of flags. There are checkpoints every few hundred meters, military posts everywhere. The men stationed there, the soldiers, wear very different insignia on their uniforms. That's because many different militias operate there, groups with different loyalties. When I was there, as always happens at some checkpoint, I stood out. And then intelligence services got involved. An intelligence officer, dressed in civilian clothes, questioned me closely and examined my German passport for a long time, checking whether the visa from Baghdad was real. He asked what we were doing in Sinjar and made it very clear that movement there is now highly regulated and very restrictive. When I first visited Sinjar in 2015, shortly after the so-called Islamic State had been pushed out, you could still basically drive into all the towns and look around freely. This time, he told me, you can go as far as Sinjun or Borek, but definitely no further. And that's where it becomes clear, even though ISIS has long been gone and its so-called caliphate destroyed, nothing here in Sinjar is truly normal yet. For the Yazidis, Sinjar is far more than just a region. It is their homeland. Until 2014, it was the main settlement area of this religious minority. Some Yazidis also live in Turkey or Syria, but most live in Iraq, specifically in Sinjar. And as I already said, in 2014, ISIS swept through the region. For the Islamist extremists of ISIS, Yazidis were considered devil worshippers, and they were brutally persecuted. Thousands were killed. Women and children were abducted. To this day, There is no trace of around 3,000 women. No one knows what happened to them. They were sold and abused as sex slaves. Entire villages were erased. Many families still do not live where they once called home. A large number of them remain in refugee camps in the autonomous region of Kurdistan. There are reasons why people do not return. The presence of many different militias, the lack of security, but also the absence of jobs and the fact that infrastructure is still destroyed. When I was there this time, it was my 10th or 15th visit to Sinjar, I also saw that in some places people have begun to return, for example to Sinun, a small town in Sinjar. Life has started again there. You see men sitting in tea houses, small shops and food stalls lining the streets, sheep being transported on pickup trucks, trucks delivering stones and building materials. At first glance, it looks somewhat ordinary again, but the memory of 2014 is everywhere, and so is the insecurity. Not far from Sinun lies Gunde Asan, a young settlement close to the mountain that gives the region its name, the Sinjar Mountain. It is a long mountain range running through the middle of the region, dividing it into north and south. This mountain became a place of refuge when ISIS arrived. People fled there. You may remember the dramatic images from August 2014, when thousands escaped to the mountain without supplies. People died there from heat stroke, thirst, and hunger, before being supplied from the air. And yet that mountain was a lifeline. That is why a settlement like Gunde Asan exists today, where hundreds of families are trying to start over near the mountain, because they fear that what happened in 2014 could happen again, and because they want to be close enough to flee there if necessary. I also visited a small school there, a project by the Caritas Refugee Aid Organization in Essen. To be transparent, I am personally involved as a volunteer with Caritas Refugee Aid. We built this school 4 years ago to create educational opportunities in Gunde Asan. In the courtyard, children stood wearing black trousers and white shirts. It looked somewhat like a school uniform from the outside, but you could tell these were not official uniforms. Everything in Sinjar is improvised.
Forty-five families live in this village. These families divide the work among themselves. Each family takes turns managing the greenhouses. When four or five families are on duty and stay here, the others take care of their own affairs. That's how it works.
This is exactly the key point. This project doesn't just generate a bit of income, it brings structure into a daily life that, for many families, had long consisted only of uncertainty. The man you heard at the beginning originally comes from Tal Azar. After the ISIS attack, like many others, he fled to the neighboring Kurdistan region. It was truly dramatic back then. As I said, August 2014. I was there a few days later and saw it firsthand. It was simply shocking. Hundreds of thousands of people were sleeping in the streets of Erbil, Duhok, and other cities in the autonomous Kurdistan region, in mosques, in schools. And what I found remarkable was how the local population, the Kurds and Kurdish residents, provided for these people because the state or the Kurdish regional government simply couldn't keep up. People even carried mattresses out of their homes so that others wouldn't have to sleep on the streets. On the one hand, it was extremely dramatic. But on the other hand, it was also impressive to see how a society organized itself and helped people in such a situation. This man, the farmer you heard earlier, returned to Sinjar in 2016. That is unusual. Most people at the time stayed in the autonomous Kurdistan region because Sinjar was extremely, extremely unsafe, much more unsafe than it is today. But he did not return to his original village.
In Tal Azar, our houses were destroyed, and they gave us nothing. So how am I supposed to go back? The Iraqi government was supposed to give families 1 million Iraqi dinars. Later, returning families were even supposed to receive 4 million dinars. But I didn't receive anything.
Yes, what he is referring to here, the 1 million Iraqi dinar, is not a large amount. I would estimate that's roughly 800 to 900 euros. Families were once promised that they would receive this money. It was paid out briefly a few months ago, but that support has since been discontinued again. So this is another key issue. If you arrive back with nothing and there are no jobs in Sinjar, then it is obviously very difficult to rebuild a life. At the same time, you also hear something different in the Greenhouse Project, namely that local employment can make a real difference for returnees.
از 2014 هم رویلیم چون و 2016 هم هاتن.
My name is Saba Caro. I come from Borek. We fled in 2014 and returned in 2016. I am a farmer by profession. This year, I was given the opportunity to work in this project. It is better here than there. We are much better off here. We enjoy working together very much. In addition, this place is close to the market.
That is, of course, part of the truth about Sinjar. Projects like the Greenhouse Initiative or the school are, at best, drops in the ocean. They can support a few families, but that's about it. There are also other initiatives, for example, by the Barzani Charity Foundation, which is a local partner we work with there. They build houses for returning families. It's almost unbelievable. Housing construction in Sinjar costs around 14,000 euros for a family of seven, so relatively little. They do this work, but of course it only helps a limited number of people. And above all, such projects do not solve the major political problems, but they do make return possible for some individuals. They cannot make up for everything that has been lost. First and foremost, people's own homes are gone, and they also cannot resolve the ongoing uncertainty. What happens next in Sinjar? How will the political conflicts there be settled? As I mentioned earlier, there are multiple militias competing for influence and control, as well as the Iraqi Federal Army and Federal Police operating there. There are Shia militias, the Hashd al-Shaabi, which are more or less controlled by Iran. Within their ranks are now also Yazidis, who earn an income through them. There are militias linked to the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party. There are also militias aligned with the Kurdish regional government in Erbil. In other words, it is an extremely complex situation, and insecurity is something you constantly hear about, the fear that ISIS could return one day. Another farmer told me very clearly, where do I sleep? How do I make a living? Do my children go to school? Is there safety? Can I stay? This farmer has a large family of 14 people and told me how difficult the years after returning have been.
It was difficult. My children worked in shops. Each of them earned 10,000 Iraqi dinars per day.
10,000 Iraqi dinars is practically nothing. 1,000 Iraqi dinars is roughly 80 euro cents. So we are talking about 8 euros per day. That is, of course, not a meaningful income. For a family of 14, this is not financial security. It is survival, nothing more. That is why I find projects like the Greenhouse Initiative so important. Not because they solve all the problems, they obviously do not, but because they give people a reason to stay, a small income, a task, a certain level of stability. And yet, even though they now have these greenhouses, and even though they provide not only a daily structure, but also an income, they still come with problems. The prices for cucumbers and tomatoes are highly volatile. They go up and down depending on how much is imported from neighboring Turkey or Syria. On top of that, there are recurring plant diseases that affect the crops. So yes, they say it is good, but it only just about allows them to live. And this just about is crucial. In the Sinjar region, it often makes the difference between leaving and staying. The economic situation is one thing. The other, perhaps even more important question is, do people here feel safe?
I'm not sure. If there were international security, it would be different. But around us, there are only Muslims and Arabs. It is difficult for us.
That is a sentence that naturally makes you pause. When someone says, Muslims and Arabs surround us, and that is difficult for us. In fact, it is true that the Sinjar region is not exclusively inhabited by Yazidis. Yazidis are the majority, but there are also many Muslim Arabs living in towns like Tal Afar or in Sinjar city itself, the largest town in the region. And many of these people, and this is part of the uncomfortable truth, were perpetrators in 2014, who immediately joined ISIS when the group swept through the area. As a result, there is still deep mistrust today. This genocide cannot simply be forgotten. How could it be when people witnessed neighbors killing neighbors, lost family members, or saw relatives being abducted? So this is, of course, extremely difficult. And accordingly, mistrust among Yazidis toward Muslim Arabs remains very, very deep to this day. The Yazidis also experienced in 2014 how all sense of security suddenly disappeared. they saw Kurdish security forces, who were supposed to protect them, withdraw overnight when ISIS arrived. That continues to fuel insecurity. This feeling does not simply go away. What the farmer, or farmers in general, experience as everyday reality, Irfan Ortak describes as political failure. Ortak is the chairman of the Central Council of the Yazidis in Germany. The council was founded in 2017 to represent the interests of the Yazidi community in Germany. For Ortak, it is clear, the military defeat of ISIS does not mean the problem is solved.
Die Lage in Shingal sieht zwar im Gegensatz vor einigen Jahren etwas entspannter aus, aber die politischen Perspektiven.
Although the situation in Sinjar appears somewhat more relaxed compared to a few years ago, the political outlook is still concerning, namely that more than 250,000 people are still living as internally displaced persons in Kurdistan, that many have not yet returned to their villages, and that Yazidi villages in Sinjar are still not fully habitable. Above all, irregular militias in Sinjar, particularly those affiliated with the PKK, and those linked to the Hashid al-Shaabi, continue to operate like a state within a state, meaning people cannot move or develop freely. All of these facts make us at the Central Council of Yazidis
immer noch quasi Staat im Staate sind und die Menschen sich nicht frei bewegen können und sich frei entfalten können. All diese Tatsachen stimmen uns als Zentralrat der Jesiden in Deutschland sehr traurig.
Yes, Ortak clearly identifies the core problem. The war may be over, but the order that should follow it has still not been established. For people who have never been there, this sounds relatively abstract, but on the ground the question is very simple. Who is actually in charge here? Who controls the roads? Who protects the people? And as long as there is no clear state answer to these questions, returning remains, for many, simply a risk. I have also seen this in places where life has visibly returned, in Sinune, for example, and in Gunde Asan, this small village where children received their report cards and dream of future professions. These places show that life is continuing, but also that it is continuing with reservations, because reconstruction is stalling. Many people have started building again, especially those still living in refugee camps in the autonomous Kurdistan region, or those renting houses and apartments there, working as day laborers, saving money, and gradually rebuilding their homes in Sinjar, because their hearts are still there and they want to return. But everything takes a very long time. This was also visible in Gunde Asan. Some houses are already finished, but many are still just shells. And in the south of Sinjar, many villages are still destroyed, still in ruins. Infrastructure remains in poor condition, mainly because Baghdad, the central government now responsible for Sinjar, is doing relatively little there. As mentioned, some families dare to return. There have also been many cases of people returning to Sinjar, only to go back again to the autonomous Kurdistan region. And many of those you speak to actually dream of going to Europe.
Obwohl der IS besiegt ist, obwohl...
Although ISIS has been defeated and no longer formally exists there, it is incomprehensible to us why Yazidis still cannot return to their homeland, why the Iraqi state and the Iraqi government are not doing everything possible to enable these people to return to their homeland, to have a long-term prospect of staying there, and to rebuild their houses.
Dass die Häuser wieder aufgebaut werden.
Yes, this criticism by Ortak is directly aimed at Baghdad, and it is not new. The Iraqi government has announced aid and promised reconstruction, but from the perspective of many Yazidis, this is happening far too slowly. Too little arrives, or nothing at all. And I mean, Germany is also providing significant funding for reconstruction. Back in 2016 or 2017, we spoke with the then German Consul General in Erbil. She told me at the time that around 67 million euros had already been invested in Sinjar on the German side. And I asked, well, I have been to Sinjar several times and haven't seen anything of it, unless underground work has been done, like a subway system, a canal system, or something like that. I really don't know where that money actually went. It later turned out that Germany had transferred this money to Baghdad, and apparently very little of it seems to have reached Sinjar. The farmer I met in the greenhouse says exactly the same thing. His house is destroyed, money was promised, but nothing ever arrived. And at the same time, there is another side. There are people who are rebuilding. There is the school principal who told me he would like to open a preschool. There are children who dream of becoming doctors or engineers. There are families building houses, even if the money is often only enough for the shell or the very first steps. And there is the greenhouse project where 45 families are working. All of this shows people are not just waiting, they are trying to help themselves. But this self-help has its limits. It cannot replace major politics. That is, I think, the core problem. Security is not guaranteed. It cannot compensate for missing state structures. What is needed is more than humanitarian aid. It requires political commitment. For this reason, Irfan Ortak's focus is not only on Iraq.
In this context, I would really like to remind the international community that it made a promise to the Yazidis, not only to defeat ISIS, but also to ensure that they can return to their homeland again.
This is an important point. Taking military action against ISIS was one thing. Enabling people to return safely afterwards is something entirely different. If you travel through Sinjar today, you can see that there is help. There are individual projects. There are schools, greenhouses, small initiatives. Clinics have been built, hospitals as well. But many Yazidis are missing something else. A comprehensive plan that ties everything together. Security, reconstruction, employment, administration, and the certainty that return is not just a brief moment, but a real long-term prospect. This is exactly where the tension in the region lies. From the outside, you can look at certain developments and say, things are improving, life has returned to Sinjar, children go to school, families work in agriculture, all of that is true. But the people I speak to say something different. Yes, we are here, but we have not truly arrived yet. Ortak becomes particularly clear when it comes to Germany.
As a German Yazidi, I really have to raise my tone in this context. I am deeply disappointed in my own government, in my own state, Germany. Apart from a few showcase projects, we see nothing for Yazidis.
Seit knapp 12 Jahren, wie sie mit diesem Genozid und mit diesem Volk umgehen.
Yes, this is the bizarre situation. Germany has formally recognized the genocide against the Yazidis as such. The German Bundestag passed a corresponding resolution and also stated that Germany bears a special responsibility to protect the Yazidis. With this genocide resolution, many naturally hoped that more would follow than just a symbolic act. Ortak says very clearly that this has not happened. He misses a broader and more sustainable approach. A plan that truly helps people leave the camps, return to their homeland, and be able to stay there. Whether one agrees with every point of this criticism or not, if you spend time in Sinjar, you understand where it comes from. I think of the farmer in the greenhouse, of his family of 14, of the children working for a few thousand dinars a day, of his statement that he has no rights in his own country, and I think of the school in Gunde Asan, of the children with their report cards, their ambition, and the headmaster who keeps going despite everything that is missing. And I also think about how absolutely necessary it is that Yazidis have a future in Sinjar. If they have no prospects there, if they are forced to leave the region for whatever reason, then this ancient religion will continue to be eroded in its homeland. At the very least, the community will remain fragmented, scattered across many different countries. There are now Yazidis living in many countries across Europe. Germany has the largest diaspora, but there are also communities in Australia, Canada, and the United States. They are spread all over the world, which is of course a major challenge for this religious community. And returning to Sinjar also means being able to live there, with a roof over your head, with an income, with schools for children, with freedom of movement, and with the trust that everything will not collapse again immediately. But it is exactly this trust that is missing. And that became very clear in the conversations I had on the ground. Irfan Ortak also describes the political side of the same problem. Too little protection, too little reconstruction, too little reliable state presence, too little consistency from the Iraqi and international side. Still, it would be wrong to end this story on a purely bleak note. Because, as mentioned, there are also people who do not give up. Teachers who teach, families who build, children who learn, farmers who stay. And my impression after this trip was, Sinjar does not need more big words. Sinjar needs action, it needs support, and above all, it needs security, reliable and under clear state control, reconstruction and compensation that actually reach people, and jobs and economic prospects that go beyond isolated projects. As long as this is missing, rebuilding Sinjar will remain extremely difficult. ISIS has been defeated militarily, but for the survivors, this story will only truly be over when they can live in safety again. The podcast was produced by Alexander Baumeister. He is also a journalist and works for a radio station within the Funke Mediengruppe. If you enjoyed this podcast, please like and follow us. It really helps make our work more visible. And feel free to write to me if you have suggestions for future episodes. chrisandmodus@funkemedien.de. Take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Ein Podcast von Funke.